very flamboyant and camp. And so I sort of go over to the police and I undo my chalk packets and I just start easily chalking on the pavement. And then slowly but surely, 200 people just sort of come over and they all start doing it together.
Imagine that, you know, taking something off the mining industry. Hard to believe. Well, it was Henry's photographs that really brought it home.
You're listening to All the Best, FBI Radio's storytelling and documentary show, every week bringing you new stories from young people around Australia.
You can always tell a chalk novice when they've got the big piece of chalk and they're holding it upright and they're just scribing it on the ground. The real trick to get massive rainbow effect as quickly as possible is to hold the chalk flat on the ground, horizontal, and then you've got the good spread and you just go really, really quickly. And
James Breckney runs a Facebook page called DIY Rainbows, and it's a bit self-explanatory.
I've been chalking rainbows now for 4 years for Equality, and there's a few, I'm like the rainbow chalk master, so there's a few tricks you've got to know. I'm not actually afraid of a bit of rain. It actually brings the colours up by 10%. You've always got to work out, is it going to be horizontal? Is it going to be vertical? And you've always got to remember, oh God, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, purple, the right order, because you don't want to get in trouble with swapping the blue with the purple.
James chalks for a cause, but he kind of fell into it by accident.
Yeah, in the queer community in Sydney, I guess I really got my beginnings when the state government tore up the rainbow crossing on Oxford Street 4 years ago. And as a joke for Facebook, I sort of chalked a rainbow behind my terrace in Surrey Hills, and the picture went viral. And people started chalking rainbows all over Australia, actually all over the world. Facebook flew me to America and I got to chalk a rainbow in like Mark Zuckerberg Square, all hail the leader. And ever since then, I've been on the board of Mardi Gras. And now, of course, the page has taken a life of its own and we chalk rainbows for marriage equality and injustices whenever we have the energy and the time to do so.
Recently, the rainbow chalkings have become a recurring symbol in the queer community, a peaceful message of solidarity.
So recently in Chechnya, some reports have come out, and initially they were quiet. It was hard to get much detail, but basically the reports say that around 100 gay men were sort of rounded up in Chechnya and put into some sort of like concentration style sort of camp and tortured and beaten. And the reports sort of suggest that at least 3 people have died. And we have more details now that people were definitely injured and this definitely sort of happened. But it's been very slow to get any traction in the mainstream media. And Russia's been very slow to react to it. Chechnya is like a republic, but it's under the control of Russia. So we decided to have a bit of a rally. And in fact, this is not the first time we've actually gone to the Russian consulate in Sydney. It's the second time. The first time was in 2013 when Putin first put out these sort of anti-gay laws where you weren't sort of really allowed to speak about gay culture in mainstream media or have posters or have symbols of gay culture. And I think that really set the tone for some of these areas like Chechnya to just, you know, develop this culture over the last couple of years, this really homophobic, transphobic culture, which is really, really scary. The 78ers approached me, and the 78ers are what we call the people who started Mardi Gras in 1978, and they wanted to do something about it. So I thought, well, let's just do the small little pavement that runs right along the Russian consulate. And so they had the energy and the gusto, which is incredible because, you know, a lot of these people are getting on now. And I had the people and the numbers and the chalking. It's just a great way to start a rally or a moment because it's very peaceful, but it really sends a message. Amazingly or sadly at the same time, it was really easy to get people involved. So around Chechnya, the hashtag is Chechnya 100 if you want to read up on it. But over in London, there was actually a rally maybe 2-3 weeks ago. So I think what the 78ers had sensed, as had I, was that nothing was going on in Australia about it. And maybe we have some responsibility to do something. When we called the event, it was only, I would say, 6 or 7 days before it was about to happen. And it took a life of its own. It was really actually easy to get people to come. I do think that a lot of the gay community had heard about what was going on, even though mainstream media wasn't covering it that well. So it was, it, In retrospect, I celebrated the fact we had over 200 people turn up in short notice to the Russian consulate on Saturday night. And I thought that was a fantastic achievement for us. But then also looking back on it now, I'm like, oh, wow, there was a real craving to do something. And there was no organization or anybody actually enabling that to happen until like literally 78ers, like five 78ers got together and wanted to make it happen. I'm a very fun person. I'm a very happy person. So sad topics I do struggle with a little bit. So I wasn't speaking. I let the 78ers speak. But what I'm really good at is setting the tone. So we kicked it off with a rainbow chalking and it was a little bit intense. We had federal police and state police there and a paddy wagon drove past. So I was really good at saying, hello, everybody. Oh, look, there's free transportation on the way home tonight. It's going to be fantastic. And I said, and the police are standing exactly, they're showing you exactly where we're going to do the chalk. Because they were standing on the pavement in front of the consulate. And I found that so interesting because I was sort of, in some ways, they're facing out, sort of protecting the consulate as opposed to sort of looking after the civilians. But on the whole, they were pretty cool. So I'm in a sort of a, to paint the scene, like a rainbow jacket that my mate tie-dyed for me. And very flamboyant and camp. And so I sort of go over to the police and I undo my chalk packets and I just start easily chalking on the pavement. And then slowly but surely, 200 people just sort of come over and they all start doing it together. And that is such a great, peaceful way to start it. Really, really nice. And then they sort of moved into the chanting. Then the 78ers spoke to the people about what they felt growing up in the 70s and the 80s with homophobia in Australia, and obviously how much worse it is at the moment elsewhere in the world, and it's 2017, which is insane. And we had a choir sing a song. It was really cute.
Unity must never die. Raise your banners high. Raise your banners high. Strength to strength and line by line.
And then this amazing 1978er Gail, she had written a letter to the Russian consulate. So she took the letter from the other side of the road and told everyone she was going to give it to the consulate.
So we're ready now. Gail, would you like to hold the letter?
Yes.
We're now about to go across. We would like a response from the Russian government.
And walked over and presented it to the gate and pressed the buzzer. No one turned up, even though we could see people in the Russian consulate.
No response, so it's going.
So she put it in the letterbox and everybody cheered.
I think it's after hours.
We had candles. It was set at dusk. It was just really, really, really intense moment and a really beautiful moment. So it was fantastic. A friend of mine on Facebook the next day said, this is so cool. My little brothers saw the chalking on Facebook just randomly. And he did say to me, even though it's not going to change anything, it's still a nice thing that you did. And I said, well, you'd actually be surprised at how many people would have told Bob Brown, you know, 20, 30 years ago when he tied himself to a tree, that, you know, he wasn't actually a policymaker. In the crowd that we had were the original 1978 and Mardi Gras that set it up. And then we had a whole bunch of like 17 and 18 and 19 year olds. And from that, you can only see where the future of Australia is going. It definitely makes a difference. And it's not going to be the guy sitting at home eating pizza pockets. So it absolutely makes a huge difference. And I think I'm so proud of everyone that attended. And it was awesome.
There's a little gem of a quote from the Dalai Lama that goes, if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. Take yourself to a warm summer night and just as you're about to go to sleep, you hear that high-pitched sound right in your ear. Your heart jumps and you're wide awake. You turn on the lights and search for the culprit, who's probably now nowhere to be seen. So lights off, you hop back into bed, close your eyes, and just as you're about to get to that beautiful sleep, there it is again. A whining mosquito whizzing past your ear and threatening a sleepless and itchy night. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and today we're sleeping with a mosquito. Sometimes, even in the face of huge adversity, all it takes is something small and persistent to move mountains. Or in the case of our next story, to save them. If Sydney was the house you grew up in, then the Blue Mountains were your beautiful backyard. They mark the edge of this giant city, and it seems crazy to think we wouldn't do all we can to protect them. If you've never been to the Blue Mountains, picture this. Morning mist settling into deep gullies and rolling blue-green eucalypt mountains as far as you can see. 10,000 square kilometres of mountain ranges, plateaus and escarpments, surrounded by rivers, rainforests and sheer sandstone cliffs. It's now listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Area, but this wasn't always the case. In this next story, we meet Henry Gold, an Austrian migrant who moved to Australia in the 50s and swiftly fell in love with the Blue Mountains. Henry began taking photographs of the natural landscapes that he loved and fought to protect. These photos would make their way into the hands of then Premier of New South Wales, Neville Wran. They became, you could say, the little mosquito in his ear that led to big change in our legislation.
The Colong Caves campaign was the classic. Mount Colong was threatened with limestone mining in the southern Blue Mountains. So we're going to quarry limestone at the Colong Caves below Mount Colong and use the Kaumung River as a dam, use the water to grind the limestone up into a slurry and then pipe it to a cement factory near Picton. They'd actually already at the time in about 1966 had mining leases and full approval to do it. But the local community and the baby conservation movement united to stop it. And those mining leases were revoked. There was a lobby book produced which was given to Neville Wran. And he then went into Parliament famously and created the Canangra Boyd National Park and extended the Blue Mountains National Park. Imagine that, you know, taking something off the mining industry. Hard to believe. Well, it was Henry's photographs that really brought it home. Okay, yeah, I should have the call sign. Keith Muir, Director of the Colong Foundation for Wilderness. We protect national parks and large intact natural areas that are known as wilderness. So my relationship with Henry Gold is through our passion for these areas and through wilderness. I've been on many walks with Henry, some of which he described as nostalgia trips, as his last trip into this particular place or that particular place.
I'm the honorary photographer of the Colong Foundation. Since its foundation, 1968, next year, half a century. It's a long time. When I take my photographs, I put my emotions into them to stir the subconscious. Because in the subconscious, everybody has an affinity with the wilderness, with the wild places. Because that's where we eventually come from. I try to stir this in people.
Every generation has a huge responsibility to the protection of these large intact natural areas, and if we don't, then they'll disappear because there are people who want to turn them into real estate and mines and logs and what have you, and they will be if they're not protected. Photographs are a key instrumental tool, and Henry has been at the forefront of promoting these values through photography.
After the war ended, we made it into Austria and finished up in Vienna. Vienna was bombed out. We were a family of four children. I had three sisters. We were all sleeping in the same room. It was awful. And I was just getting fed up. I just wanted to get out of the place. And the only thing I knew about Australia, my father had a picture book, which was called The Wonders of the World. And it had a chapter on Australia. which had a picture of the Blue Mountains. I couldn't see a single dwelling. I had this beautiful view of wild country, those dark, mysterious valleys. It was just beautiful. And when I came here, the first thing I did, I caught a train to Blackheath and walked to Evans Lookout and had a look down into the valley, because the caption on that picture in my father's book said Evans Lookout. I just saw it in nature and I thought, all this unspoiled country, it just has to stay like that. It just can't be developed like these European places. The first environmental fight that came up was the Kowloon Caves, and my photographs were used for the first fight, and it just went on from there on for the last half century.
There were things called lobby books. Lobby books are usually pictorial in nature. The idea of a lobby book is to let the images speak for the area in the most eloquent way possible, by wowing the socks off the parliamentarians. Gee, we've got this, wow, well, that's good, why don't we protect this? So Henry's good at that.
The decision makers, they don't know the areas. Some of them never go there. You have to show them what the place looks like. And many of the decision makers have actually changed their minds in favour after seeing the photographs.
Greater Blue Mountains World Heritage Listing Campaign, that came to a climax at the 2000 National World Heritage Committee meeting in Cairns. We compiled a lobby book consisting of Henry Gold photos and quotes by eminent botanists, and that's all it was. And they went like hotcakes. They were very popular. Everybody wanted a picture book of the Blue Mountains.
The World Heritage Committee was undecided to the last moment, and it was just an act of desperation by us. It's just thrown together on a copy machine. It was just run off at the last moment, very quickly. I just threw it together, presented it to them. The next day it was unanimous. Just amazing, really.
Critics were saying the area was too degraded. The pictures showed these broad acres of wilderness, and that was the end of that argument.
It required a lot of bushwalking, pretty hard bushwalking. Lots of experiences, lots of funny happenings, particularly during the flights we did, the aerials. I can tell you some stories. It was a very cold June morning. We turned up at the Bankstown Airport. We had this young fellow who was going to fly us. And he greeted us and he had this sheepish look on his face. And he said, I couldn't get a plane that they can open the window. So I took the door out. So I sat there, strapped down in the seat with a gaping hole next to me where the door used to be, you know. And a cold wind blowing just after a cold change. Can you imagine the temperature? It didn't take very long. We had only been in the air for about 10 minutes. It was just freezing up. The pilot, he couldn't operate any knobs anymore. And we had a navigator in the back. He was mumbling. His lips were all frozen up. He couldn't talk anymore. I couldn't even handle the camera anymore. It was just frozen up. So we just turned around and coming back. It was the end of that flight.
Anyway, the area became World Heritage listed. Well, the quote's from Wallace Stegner, and we're looking at the Oxley Wild Rivers. We're looking from Longnose Point into the Maclay Gorges Wilderness. And the quote reads, "We simply need that wild country available to us, even if we never do more than drive to its edge and look in. For it can be a means of reassessing ourselves, of our sanity as creatures, as part of the geography of hope. Well, you know, that's a strong and beautiful statement, but what does it really mean? I mean, we've got these beautiful, natural and intact areas, but we don't, in our daily lives, know anything about them. We've forgotten that they exist, and we forget that we are, in fact, animals, that we are from nature, that wasn't that long ago, that we were just in forests as animals. We were smart animals, but we were just in forests, and we were just living day to day in this wild nature. We've totally forgotten all that. We think that everything comes from supermarkets in boxes. Everything is made very comfortable for us, and we live three times what we would have in a wild and wilderness situation. How does it get back to sanity? Well, our world is pretty crazy, you know. We've got these totally artificial environments that we live in, and yet we need them. We've become sort of dependent on our artificial landscape, and it's quite a surprise when you realise that and you think, well, where did we come from? What were we like?
The passage quoted by Keith Muir in the end of that story is a quote by Wallace Stegner, who is an American novelist and environmentalist. That story was by Joe Koning. The housing market in Australia is stuffed. Finding a place to rent in one of our capital cities is incredibly difficult. And one time or another, we've all had to make compromises about where we'll live and what we'll settle for. Dodgy wiring? Sure. An hour commute to work? Fine. A mosquito might be invading your bed and keeping you up at night, but it's a small price to pay for the perfect place. Now, what about trees? Trees don't usually relocate, at least not by choice. They have deep roots to where they are. But if trees could rent like us, move around like us, and choose where they live like us, what compromises would they make? What would they look for? And what would be their deal breakers? In this strange little piece of fiction, Emma Nobel imagines a Melbourne where trees are also trying to find places to live and making compromises just like us.
I'm not fussy. I just want a place to settle down. Smell the roses, you know. Or not roses. They're so overrated.
You wouldn't think it's so hard to set down roots.
South Bank.
Stop right there. Three words. Dutch elm disease. If there's one place those bark beetles will go, it's the botanical gardens. It's the postcode with a death sentence. I don't mess with that shit.
Windsor. Wow, everything is so close together. Hey, I see you showering and picking your nose at the same time. Do you think that's a little bit counterintuitive?
St Kilda. Backpackers everywhere.
Hawthorne.
Is she going to throw that? You cannot... Does this park look like a garbage truck? Richmond.
Ugh, where am I going to go? The Burnley Golf Club? Getting golf balls stuck in my branches? No thank you. And then people climbing up to get them? Like, take it as a sign. You're not Tiger Woods. Go home. Footscray.
Hey, this is better. Bigger. More space.
South Yarra.
Look at the park. How quaint. So many little dogs. And not enough people with little black doggy do-bags. Yes, hello, darling. I see you. Without your little doo-doo bag. Get away from me.
Fitzroy North. Edinburgh Gardens, it's okay, I guess. The tennis club has fences. Plenty of space to grow.
Yarraville.
Hey, nice. I mean, the truck fumes are a bit smelly. Lots of small dogs. They could shit on me. They will shit on me.
Elwood. There's a stream. It borders two schools, but there's a stream. I could lean over that. Then it would be my stream.
Toorak.
St. Peter's Catholic Church. A church? Well, I wouldn't say I'm a religious tree, but... nice high hedges. A space for gentle contemplation. I'd be the centerpiece of the whole block.
We all make compromises. I guess it'll have to do for now.
If Trees Could Rent was produced by Emma Nobel. The supervising producers were Beck Fari and Selena Shannon. And the trees were performed by T. Butler, Chloe Keel and Anthea Galanis. Big thank you to all the contributors who worked on this week's episode. And if you're listening and think you want to make something for All the Best, well, we'd love to hear from you. To get involved, shoot us an email at ep@allthebestradio.com. We take story pitches from new and emerging radio makers from all around Australia, and it's totally okay if you haven't made stories for radio before. We can help with that and give you training and support. Just get in touch and we'll take it from there. That's ep@allthebestradio.com. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon, our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari, our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie, Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. This week's episode was compiled by Selena Shannon and I'm Jess Hamilton. Our artwork is designed by Annie Hamilton and our theme music is composed by Shining Bird. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and better yet, leave us a review.